apologize. I have a call at the moment, so if there's any problems to understand me, just let me know, and then I can turn the voice up on the button. I think my talk will be quite different than the talks we have here up to now. There will be a lot more physics. So what I will do is I will show how one can use measurements for quantum computing and for the generation of entanglement with high fidelity. And this work was done together with Jeremy Metz. He is the PhD student who's done most of the work. But we also had help from Christian Schön and from Michael Trubke. It seems the first speaker just arrived, but maybe I just got in. So let's start from the beginning. My talk fits in well with what John Preskill was telling you about yesterday. I want to repeat what you need to build a quantum computer. One of the problems that concerns people who are interested in or ask the question when we will have a useful quantum computer is that you want to have a machine that is not vulnerable to parameter fluctuations. And in many physical systems, you also have spontaneous decay rates, and you don't want to have leakage of the information that you want to process into the environment. And there are more or less three solutions for that. One, of course, is topological quantum computing, and we hear a lot about this. Another solution is quantum error correction, and John Preskill talked about this. And I will talk about measurement-based quantum computing, and especially about the work that we've been doing over the last 2 years. So I will use the same introduction like John used yesterday. So where are we now? Is one of the big successes up to now in practical implementation of quantum computing is ion-trap quantum computing. And this is a picture of Rainer Blatt's lab. Of course, it's a really big machine. But what they have done is they are now able to entangle up to 8 ions. They say they can do more, but they're more interested in doing more interesting work with it. So they do quantum error correction, try to implement small algorithms. And what I will do now is I will have a closer look at one of the things that makes it possible to actually have these experiments working with a very high fidelity. And one of the reasons why it works so well is that they have actually something that they can read out the qubits at the end of the unitary operation with a very high precision. So what we do now is we have a closer look into how they read the state of the qubit, and then later we use that for entanglement generation. So the idea for the readout of a single qubit is actually very, very simple. What you want to do is you want to do an idea measurement on a qubit. So and an ideal measurement is defined in a way that you have a projection. So you start in a superposition C equals alpha 0 plus beta 1. And afterwards, you want your system, your qubit, your single qubit, to be in 0 with probability alpha modulo squared, or it is in 1 with probability beta modulo squared. And that's not enough. You also want to know which projection has happened. So you want to have that indicated somehow on a measurement device. And you want to have exactly the right probabilities. And it's very easy to do that. The only thing you need to do is you apply a laser pulse. So you apply a laser pulse that couples, for example, the state 1 to an excited state, and then it decays. And what happens is that when you start in a superposition, alpha 0 plus beta 1, then you have photons coming out randomly. And one possibility is that you have no photon coming out. But when you see no photon coming out from an atom, then you learn that the atom is in a state where it cannot emit. And the longer you wait and the longer you see no photon, you know it is in a state where it cannot emit. So the no photon time evolution projects a qubit onto the state 0. But then there's also a chance that a photon comes out. And once the first photon has come out, there will be many more. So you have either no photons or many photons coming out, and depending on the measurement outcome, you're either in 0 or in 1. And when these experiments became possible, people had a look on how to model this thing in quantum systems, and one of the approaches they used to describe the time evolution of an atom is the quantum jump approach, and it gives a non-emission Hamiltonian, which describes the non-photon time evolution, and that can be used then to show that the probabilities are exactly the ones that you would also expect for an ideal measurement. So the idea for the measurement is really like the, you have either no photon, that means you are at the end in zero, or you have many photons, then you are in one, and that works with a very high precision. So the advantages are this readout is very simple and precise. It works even when you use real photon detectors, and it does not matter on how you do the measurement. I mean, it matters how you do the measurement, but it doesn't matter what parameters you use to do the measurement, because what you do is a projection. So you project exactly into the state 0 or 1, and it doesn't matter how, what exactly the very frequency of the laser was to do the projection. So one thing that is a bit more interesting, very closely related to this, is macroscopic quantum jumps. So I will talk also a little bit about this, and then later we use these two techniques to create entanglement. So quantum jumps have been a very hot topic longer time ago. So the debate on quantum jumps goes back, for example, to 1913. So a reason why I bring it up is that a quantum computer is always a single quantum system. So we have to apply quantum mechanics to single quantum system, not to ensembles. And in 1913, they had a discussion about this by Schrödinger, who liked his wave equation. He said that you should not apply quantum mechanics to a single quantum system because this leads to nonsense, as like quantum jumps. And Bohr was someone who probably had a much closer look into the spectrum of hydrogen and things like that. And they saw that hydrogen, for example, when they do spectroscopy on it, it would emit photons at very fixed frequencies and at a different series of frequencies. So he was suggesting there must be something like a quantum jump, that the electron suddenly jumps from one level, energy level, to another energy level, and emits photon at a certain frequency. So you have a sudden change that does not fit very well into the Schrödinger equation. Klaus Müller was telling me recently that Bohr later wrote a paper where he kind of withdrew a little bit from this quantum jump picture. There's a very nice review paper then later by Blatt and Soller from 1988 about quantum jumps. But the topic was more or less settled in 1975 by Demel, who said that we can actually see this jumping of a single atom if we look into if you do experiments with single ions. So we have a single quantum system, we drive it with a laser, and then the fluorescence of that single atom would exhibit something that is called macroscopic quantum jumps. So you have you drive an atom with a laser, and you would see a random fluorescence telegraph signal of either emitting lots of photons or no photons. Here's a little toy model that has this kind of behavior. So you have a ground state, you have a state B and an excited state E, and we would drive with a laser. Here, for example, we have strong decay rates here, and we have a very weak decay rate that can lead into a, for example, into a superposition of B and D. And then, as we have said before, seeing photons is something like having a measurement done on your system. So that means when you see many photons, you know there's some time evolution going on between G, B, and E. So you have these states emitting many photons. And then if you don't see a photon for a while, you fall into this dark state, and then even if you fall into a superposition, the system will stay there, and then you have some macroscopic fluorescence signal. So Demel proposed that in 1975, and then the experiment was done in 1986. There were three groups who did these experiments. And they saw exactly this random, this macroscopic quantum jumps. The funny thing about it maybe is that there are two papers that PRL, two papers that are published back to back in PRL. And one of them is involves Rainer Blatt, and the other one involves Dave Feynman. So they are, it's a long tradition in back to back papers. What you can do is you can describe that the system doing a quantum jump analysis. I won't give all the details for this, but the important thing is if we know how the non-photon time evolution of the system is described, and we know exactly what happens in case of a photon emission, and we know exactly what are the probabilities for an emission, then we can analyze the statistics of this light and dark period, and we can calculate, for example, the characteristic time scale, so we can calculate what is the mean length of the dark period, what is the mean length of the light period, and the other important time scale is the mean time between photon emissions, and you can calculate all of this and then analyze exactly what parameters you need in order to get this effect. So here is, to emphasize that a little bit, we show here a simulation of the time evolution of a system. For example, you have many photons coming out, and then the population in the dark state is more or less zero. But once you have a photon emission of a type that creates some population in the dark state, then there's a chance that a certain probability that the atom does not emit more photons. And while you see no photons coming out, so that's what happening, it's happening here, then the state of the system goes into the dark state, and once it's there, it stays there, and you have exactly that dark state with a very high precision. Here's an example where it doesn't work out. So we have a certain photon emission that creates a bit of population in this dark state that cannot emit photons. Then its population increases, but as soon as you have a photon again, the system is back into, and then the, so it's a very characteristic behavior. And our idea was to use exactly this kind of effect for the generation of entangled atomic pairs. So what we did is we tried to find a system that exhibits this macroscopic light and dark period, but in a way that the dark state belongs to a maximally entangled state, because then you don't need to do anything for the generation of entanglement. You just drive the system with a laser field. You look at the intensity, and when it gets dark, then you know the system is in an entangled state. So what we practically do is we measure whether the system is in an entangled state or not. And the small deviations from the ideal measurement, they make the transitions from a light into a dark period and a dark into a light period. But if it's small deviations from a measurement, then that's why these periods of fluorescence and no fluorescence are very long. So here the generation of a maximally entangled atom pair is really triggered on a macroscopic signal. This is the level scheme. So what we want is we want a three-level atom. Our qubits are two ground states, so they have very long lifetime. One transition couples with some detuning to the cavity mode. And we have a laser that drives here. And then we have a laser that couples these two states directly. And what you can do then is, or what I should say, what is the important point is, the only thing we assume is that the laser enters from the side, and both atoms see the same Rabi frequency of the laser field. What we assume is that both atoms see exactly the same coupling constants. That means the interaction or the Hamiltonian is symmetric with respect to exchanging both atoms. And if you do that, then you can go into a state basis, or you can introduce a basis that is symmetric with exchanging the atoms. And what we also assumed is that the detuning of the upper level is quite big, so we can adiabatically eliminate this state and the cavity mode. So what we are left with is we have a symmetric subspace that consists of 0, 0, a symmetric state S0, 1, which is 0, 1, plus 1, 0, and the 1, 1 state, And whenever you are in these three states, photons can be placed in the cavity and leak out. So when you are in these states, a lot of photons will come out through the cavity mirrors. And then we have a laser that always puts the system back into 1-1 so that you can really have photon emissions at a certain rate. Then there's always a small amount of population also in excited states because you never have a perfect process. So due to the adiabatic elimination, there's an epsilon of population up here. And then when you have a spontaneous emission, you might sometimes fall into the antisymmetric state, and that is the dark state of the system. And then the system cannot emit photons, and it's practically stuck there for a macroscopically long time. So if you draw it in a different way, then this system is exactly equivalent to the toy model that I was showing you earlier. That's why I showed you this toy model. So we have mainly a strong driving on this side and a very weak transition here. But whenever we fall into here, the emission through the cavity mirror stops and the system is kind of projected onto this anti-symmetric state. And what Jeremy did then is he put in some realistic parameters and did a quantum jump simulation. So these are the photon counts. And then you really see that there are a lot of photons coming out averaged over a time period. And then suddenly it stops. And then it starts emitting again. So in order to create an entangled state, the only thing one needs to do is one drives the system, one waits until no photon is detected for a certain time, then one can switch off the lasers and the atoms are in a maximally entangled ground state. And what we did then is we calculated what are the characteristic timescales of the system. So important are the mean time between cavity photon emissions, the mean length of a light period, and the mean length of a dark period. And then you can kind of show what are the parameters in order to make. So crucial for distinguishing a light period from a dark period is that the dark period is much longer than the mean time between photon emissions within the light period. And it turned out that, for example, the mean length of the dark period is a multiple of the mean length of the mean time between two photons in a light period multiplied with something like 7 g squared over kappa gamma. G squared is the coupling of the atoms to the cavity, and kappa and gamma are the decay rates. So when you have g squared over kappa gamma equal to 10, then the mean length of a dark period is already 70 times longer than the mean length, mean time between two photon emissions within the light period. I mean, you can distinguish it very well. And so we can use this for the entangled state preparation with much worse systems than what is has been proposed before. So the idea is you detect photons, and if you don't haven't seen a photon for a mean length of a dark period, you just turn off the lasers, and then you get fidelities well above 99%. So that is a kind of logarithmic plot. The other thing is, because everything is triggered on a macroscopic signal, you can now have bad detector efficiencies. So you can have a detector efficiency of 20%, and you still know when your state preparation succeeded and when not. So we also did more detailed calculations for finite detector efficiencies, and this is the fidelity for the case where you wait a relatively long time. It then depends only on the detector efficiency multiplied with C, and C is this cooperativity parameter that almost all schemes depend on, or you can compare atom cavity schemes normally by saying what this parameter is. So it's G squared over kappa gamma. Most schemes need that C is of the order of at least 100 or 200 to get some fidelities above in the order of 90%. And here we get, even for C equals 1, we get fidelities of 85%. So to summarize it, what that means, we can now prepare entangled states without any coherent control. So you don't implement a unitary operation, you just let the system do what it would do anyway. and then wait for a dark period. It's robust against parameter fluctuation, exactly as the readout measurement, because we do a projection and we don't care how this projection is done. We can allow larger decay rates than other schemes. We can allow for finer detector efficiencies, which is the main difference to dynamic computing schemes, and it's more or less deterministic. The thing we really rely on is that that both atoms couple to lasers and cavities in a very symmetric way. So as long as we keep that symmetry up, it works very well. And the natural way of scaling it up would be to say, let's now place more than two atoms in the cavity. We did that for a little bit and it becomes very tedious. So we had to come up with a new idea in order to build cluster states with microscopic fluorescence signals.
And then this is, did you show us the sensitivity to symmetry?
No, I didn't show you. But the thing is that the dark state changes if it's not, if both atoms see the same gene, then the dark state becomes slightly weighted. So it would be something like 0.1 times the g of the first atom minus g of the second atom, 1.0. So it's slightly fluctuates there.
So in the scheme, are you using the two states that you have labeled ket0 and ket1 as spanning the qubit?
Yeah, so these are the qubit states.
But is it a disadvantage that they have different energies, so a relative phase between them will evolve in time?
No, because one can do everything with respect to an interaction picture, where that doesn't matter.
Qubits are this way.
Yeah, the reason I drew it this way, or you can write a Hamiltonian where they are just exactly at the same level, but the important thing is for us is that in this way, you can have a microwave transition to drive it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more. But I think that they need to do that also in the Eintrap's experiments to keep a little bit of track how the time is.
Yes.
So it's in a controlled way, but it's there. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the main idea is to keep everything symmetric and to measure the anti-symmetric state. That's the main idea. So what we do now is we came up with, we tried to find a way how we can, I mean, making an entangled state is maybe interesting enough. And a lot of people are setting up experiments now where they have atom cavity systems and want to do something with them even if they are not perfect. And you want to have fidelities above 50% at least to claim that you can do entanglement. But it's much more interesting if you can really scale it and make cluster states for one-way quantum computing. And once you have made a cluster state for one-way quantum computing, then the only thing you need to do afterwards is single qubit rotations and the readout of qubits, and that is what the Eintrap people can do already very well. So what we found is that there is a way of making cluster states with the help of parity measurements, and I think this idea goes back to Brown and Rudolph, who use parity measurements for making cluster, for proposing schemes for cluster state growth in linear optics quantum computing. Just shortly the idea. So the what you could do is you could create an entangled atom pair and then take two atoms, so each from one pair, and perform a parity measurement on them by projecting onto the state 0101 plus 1010. That means you measure whether there's one atom in one and one atom in zero, but you don't distinguish which one it actually is, that is in zero, and which one is in one. And this can be used to make shorter clusters, like an entangled pair is a short, a two-qubit cluster. You can use that to to make a larger cluster out of that. If it succeeds and you project onto this state, then you have in principle four atom entanglement. Or if you measure 0011, then it fails, but then cluster state allows to have probabilistic schemes. And then once you succeeded in making larger clusters, linear clusters, it's also possible to fuse linear clusters into 2D clusters. we were interested in how can we implement a parity measurement, this classical flow sensing. So we again want to have something that is a measurement that just projects into the state 0, 1, and 1, 0 without distinguishing between them, but in a way that everything is triggered on a microscopic signal. And it turns out that this is even easier than making entangled pairs. So what we do now is instead of, like before we were looking for this light and dark pairs, what we do now is we drive this laser field and we just measure the amount of fluorescence that comes out of the system. So what we're trying to do is we try to measure how many of the atoms in the cavity are actually in zero and how many are in one without finding out which one is the one that was in one. And the cavity is something that creates this kind of indistinguishability of the two atoms because they couple in the same way to the cavity, so we want to learn which one it actually was that created the cavity photons. And in order to do that, you need nothing else than a laser that and a cavity coupling and a strongly tuning, so that the purpose of the laser is to establish a coupling of the state to the cavity mode. And the surprising thing is what comes out is that there are really only three fluorescence levels. When both atoms are in zero, then you won't see any photons coming out. If both atoms are in one, you have photons coming out at a very high rate. But if one of them is in one, we have photons coming out at the medium rate. And I will show you why. Maybe what I should say first before we go into more details is it's not, technically it's not unfeasible. So what this scheme requires is to really, you can create pairs and you have to be able to move atoms around. So what we need, what we require is to move the two atoms that we want to fuse together, that we want to attain into a cavity, and then move them out and then move the next one in and so on. And there are a lot of experiments currently on the way preparing this kind of experiments, and they're hopefully a bit smaller than the experiment by the Eintrap experiments. So what people are interested in there are miniaturizing quantum optics experiments by using atom chips. One example is the group of Heinz in London. So these are pictures from their experiment. So they have an atom chip, which is more or less a chip. It's a semiconductor chip or something. Then they have some gold on it, and then they can etch lines into there. And one of the important principle is that if, for example, they put small wires, or they in that way they create a small wire. In that wire, they can send a current through, and that creates a magnetic field. And then they superimpose the magnetic field with another magnetic field, and then they create a kind of minima somewhere. And when they have cold atoms, then the cold atoms get trapped here above the wire. And then by putting voltages on, they can move the atoms back and forth. And what they have succeeded now is to also take glass fibers and cut them and treat them in a way that they put two fibers and the tips very close together. And then in that way, they can put very strong coupling cavities on top of the chips. So there's a lot of work currently in preparation in this direction. And also a lot of ion trap people, they try to get away from this big experiments that they have at the moment and trying to make ion chips, ion trap chips. Like Vinnie Hensinger's group already has demonstrated that you can move an ion around the corner without losing its coherence and things like that. So there are things in preparation. I don't think it will be the ultimate quantum computer that we have at the end. We'll make out of this kind of chips, but it is definitely, it will allow for entangling much more than 8 ions. One of the reasons why people mount chips, mount cavities on top of this chips is also that in that way you can really, for example, link computers later and things like that. But let's come back to what I have to show you now is, or what I should show you now is that this kind of laser field or this kind of quantum optics configuration really realizes a parity measurement. So some simulations, for example, using this quantum jump approach that I was showing in the beginning, and then we created some trajectories. So let's assume we have two maximally entangled atom pairs, and we take one atom, let's say the second atom from the first pair, and the first atom from the second pair, and put them together in the cavity. Then the state that you have is something like 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 0, 1, 0. And if you project onto this state where you have a 1, 0 here and a 0, 1 here, then you have a four atom, four qubit entanglement. And this is an example. So we start with this state, and then we say, let's have a look at. So we really want to project onto this state and this state, and this shows the population in this state. And if, for example, you have a relatively low emission rate and it takes quite a long time before your first photon is emitted, then the population in, then, so the important thing is, while you have no photon for a relatively long time, you learn that the state 1, 1 is probably not populated. But you don't learn that only the state 0, 0 is populated. And once you have a photon here, then you kind of exclude the state where you have 0, 0 of the two atoms. So it kind of reaches this level. But the thing is, once the atoms are in that subspace where only 0, 1, and 1, 0 are populated, then they just stay there. So there are no processes that do the mixing of different subspaces again. So the system really converges into one subspace. And that's the important idea here, is we have three subspaces. One is where the atoms are in 0, 0. You project there by having no photons at all. Then the state 1, 1 is, once you are there, you have a high rate. And even if you start in a superposition, it converges into one of the three possible subspaces. And then each of it is characterized by a certain intensity of photons. Here, for example, is something where the system takes a while to kind of go and to decide which subspace it actually belongs to. So you have photons at a relatively high rate, which means we project into the subspace where most of the population is in the 1, 1 state. But then there are sometimes where there is no photon for a relatively long time, and then the other subspace takes over. But the important point is, once the system decided what subspace it is in, you have hardly any fluctuation and it just stays there. And the important thing is why we can create entanglement during this process in a controlled way is that we never learn which atom is creating the photons. That means when we project on the subspace that is belongs to 0, 1, and 1, 0, we really don't know which atom it was. So in order to do a parity measurement, what one can do is one can take a certain time and count the detector clicks that you have in the time interval. And this is the fidelity for the projection. And if you have in your time interval, in this example, for example, 10 clicks, then you know the parity measurement succeeded. If you have more clicks, then you just say, okay, let's do it again. And then one can do all kinds of analysis. But the main thing is that you have discrete fluorescence levels, and they tell you exactly how many atoms are in one, and you project exactly in a way that you have a parity measurement. You can also take finite detector efficiencies into account. Here's something we are still working on, where the numerics and the analytics, so the numerics works better than the analytics. So I hope the numerics is the one that it's a small difference only anyway. And it turns out it works very similarly well, because the physics is more or less the same as in the first scheme I showed you. So we can also have relatively large decay rates, and still we have can prepare entanglement with a very high fidelity. So the advantages of and disadvantages of growing cluster states in this way are, we really need no, we don't need any coherent control. Again, you just shine a laser on it and you see, you measure the photons. So it's robust against parameter fluctuation because it's a measurement. you can allow large decay rates and detect an efficiency of 20% out of problem. One of the problems that is not very emphasized, but one of the problems is, for example, that even if a photon is generated, it often gets stuck in the mirrors, for example. So a lot of the experiments that I have seen, the actual rate is how they really get a photon out is close to 10%. So even if I say it works for 20%, a lot of the experimentalists, they start complaining and people say it's not good enough. The problem is, not really a problem, but maybe the disadvantage is that it works only in this 50% success rate, because let's see, it's 50% that we project onto the state that we need in order to create entanglement. Again, symmetry is very important. I'm emphasizing this because I don't want to give the impression you get something for free. So, I think symmetry is very important. Well, symmetry is the one that kind of allows us to get entanglement. And one of the differences to the previous scheme is that now we project not onto a 1D subspace, but onto a 2D subspace. That means we don't project on a maximally entangled 2-qubit state, but on a 2D subspace of span by 0, 1, and 1, 0. That means there might be some errors that come in that are due to mixing between the two states. But there are some ways of minimizing them.
I'm sorry, one question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean symmetry in your case? Symmetry is a commutation or a swapping?
We assume again that that both atoms see the same coupling constant, for example, in order to that. Otherwise, if one would see a coupling constant that is bigger than the other one, then seeing a photon would tell you that it's probably was the second atom, and that would give you an imbalance. Then it would not be a projection just onto 0, 1, and 1, 0, but it would project a bit stronger on one state than the other.
So you mean symmetry, actually symmetry means identical particles?
The word identical particles, it's a bit difficult to use that here. I mean, identical maybe in a sense that they're both treated in exactly the same way, but they're not identical because they're not, you can distinguish them. That's the first one, that's the second one.
And another question, I mean, in your case, the projection somehow like an entanglement is working. Do we have?
Not really.
Oh, really?
No, because we don't put entanglement in.
No, I mean, you need the entanglement from the measurement.
I wouldn't, in this case, I would say it's entanglement swapping. So what we do is we start in a product state, for example, where we have 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1 populated. So you could have an equal superposition of these four states. But what you do by measuring that there's one atom in the cavity, you damp away, you exclude the cases 0, 0, and 1, 1. So you're left with 0, 1, plus 1, 0, if you want a 2-qubit example. So you project onto that, just via. But it's not that we have to put in some entanglement to get some other entanglement out. It's really a projection. So it's similar to the readout of a qubit. You measure, and then you get exactly what you want.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when I started and how much time I have left.
I'm still here, 15 minutes.
Okay. So what I can do is, you can ask me lots of questions later, but what I also want to do is, I want to say a little bit more on measurement-based quantum computing in general. What are the basic ideas, and then I summarize it. So the basic idea of measurement-based quantum computing is that, okay, you measure. That's one important part of it, of course. The other thing is you're never allowed to measure on your qubits, because once you measure your qubits, then your qubits are measured. So they are, they cannot carry information anymore. So what we normally need is we need some ancillas. And so we have some computational inputs, which are our qubits. We have some ancillas. And they interact somehow with each other. And then you measure, so for example, in linear optics, there would be some linear operations. And then you measure on your ancillas. So in linear optics, for example, would mean you have a linear optics setup, you send lots of photons in. If you have five ancillas, you measure five photons afterwards, but you don't know anymore which ones They might, the ones you measure might actually be the ones that were initially carrying your qubits and your information. The important thing about this measurement is to measure in a way that you don't learn anything about the information that you had encoded in your qubits. And if you don't learn anything about the information, so if you measure in a basis that is mutually unbiased with respect to the logical qubits, then what you implement is you implement a unitary operation between your input, between your qubits and the output qubits, or you can generate entanglement if you want. The advantages we get out here is actually by nobody tells you that the qubits and the ancillas have to be of the same type. So what we are doing here is that our ancillas are actually a different type than the qubits. So in the examples I was showing you here, and also in other examples we have worked on in the past, we always got some advantages by making our qubits, for example, making them out of atoms, and the ancillas, they were, for example, light states. So, and what that does is it makes it very easy to have an interaction between the computational qubits and the ancillas. So ancillas in the example that I showed here, for example, would be the field inside the cavity. So we measure this field inside the cavity, but since the field in the cavity doesn't distinguish between the different atoms, we don't learn enough about our qubits to destroy some coherences. Might not fit exactly on the cluster state growth that I was discussing here, but it was a lot of it kind of summarizes a lot of the work we have done. So you get some advantages by having this, for example, in England they would say a stationary qubit, and ancillas that are flying qubits. And often in physics, when you have interactions, then they are often between two different types. So an atom is not interacting with another atom. I don't know examples for that. We have an atom interacting with an atom. You always have it mediated via something else, for example, via photons. So dipole-dipole interaction is in principle something where the two atoms that interact exchange photons. So it's easier to control an interaction between, or to have in this box some interaction that is between atom and a photon, instead of trying to use an interaction that is between an atom and an atom. And then you can also measure easily photons because they come out, they fly to your detector and you just count the clicks. So it's a lot of the work we have done over the last years is not always, maybe the doesn't make much sense in terms of mathematics, but it makes things easier from a practical point of view. Some examples for quantum computing using dissipation. We came up with a scheme that used measurements on the Zener effect in 2000, and then there are quite a few other schemes afterwards also based on Zener effects. For example, Jim Frenzen had a very nice example on with fibers where they do a Zener measurement on photons. What we did here is we kind of combine lots of ideas. The big progress was Rosendorf and Bringer with their one-way quantum computing scheme, because that is really the main thing that allows probabilistic gates, and most measurements that are that can be used for quantum computing are probabilistic. There's sometimes way around that. And then of course this idea became a lot more famous by with the mini optics quantum computing scheme by Knüller, Flamm and Milburn. So what we do is we really replace interactions by measurements, and with photons it's the only thing you can do because you don't get photons to interact with each other efficiently. So as final remarks, what we did, of course, I showed you two schemes. One was about creating entangled pairs via the observation of this macroscopic light and dark variance, and then we showed that similar ideas can be used from parity measurements. By measuring a fluorescence, you can implement a parity measurement. So the philosophy behind this, we look for what kind of easily available measurements a system has, and then we use them to create entanglement with a high fidelity. And in this case, what interests the atom cavity experimented with moths is that we can allow them to have higher decay rates and also to use relatively bad photon detectors. And I think if I want to summarize what are the main components that we use, and I think it's the kind of symmetry in the sense of that both atoms are treated in exactly the same way. Then we used a lot the hybrid character of the system. So we have atomic qubits, but we have what we measure is photons. And then dissipation also plays a very big role, because without dissipation you wouldn't have a projection into a subspace. So it's not unitary evolutions, you really want to have something non-unitary happening. And these are the main publications related to